Tonight we are talking about sympathetic joy or mudita. And I'd like to start with a question. Have you ever received a text from a close friend sharing incredible news? They got their dream job, they bought a house, they fell in love. And for a split second, before you typed congratulations, you felt a subtle, sharp sting of tightness in your chest. Imagine scrolling through social media. You see someone you went to school with, or perhaps someone right here in our local community, or your local community if you're not in the Central Florida area, announcing a major milestone in their lives. And universally, we know what we should feel, pure happiness. But if we are honest with ourselves in the quiet of our meditation practice, what often bubbles up first is a quiet tracking calculation. We look at their milestone, and then we look at our own life, and we ask, am I falling behind? Why them and not me? This response is totally valid. It's not that you're a bad person if you have it. It's not that you're a poor meditator if you have it. It simply means that we possess a human nervous system wired for comparison. Mudita, or sympathetic joy, is the intentional antidote to this exact sting that I talked about at the very beginning. It is a vicarious, unselfish, sympathetic joy, the rare and beautiful ability to delight purely in the happiness, the achievements, the good fortune of others. Now, notice I said it was the intentional antidote. That means we've thought about it and we're wanting to do this, we're doing it. It is not something that just comes by happenstance right away. And it is, mudita is in stark contrast with our modern conditioning in today's world. Western psychology notes how we are trained to see life through a scarcity mindset. A zero-sum game where we subconsciously believe that someone else's win leaves less room for our own success. If they got this, what I have is less. Mudita completely deconstructs this by framing joy as an infinite communal resource. It's intentional, infinite, and a communal resource. Mudita is within the framework of the Brahma Viharas, which are the four divine abodes or boundless states, which includes loving kindness or metta, compassion or karuna, and equanimity or upekkha. These are heart-opening practices designed to purify our interactions with the world. Heart opening. Think about that for a minute. We've talked about loving kindness a lot in this organization, and I'm sure if you've gone to retreats or listened to other teachers, listened to meditation talks online, loving kindness is everywhere. We've talked about compassion. We've talked about self-compassion. We've talked about equanimity. We've talked about heart-opening practices. We're not done. So now we're talking about this one, mudita, sympathetic joy. It is a practice. And I'll come back to that concept of a practice later, but what I have been talking to people about in the last several days is practicing. And recently, I was talking to someone who is trying to finish their associate's degree, and they struggle with school, and they've struggled with school a long time. She's in her 40s and she wants to finish the associate's degree. And she eventually wants to get her bachelor's degree. But she really wants to finish the associate's degree by May. She has four classes left. And she's struggling. And she asked me, did I think she could do an 8-week version of each one of those classes instead of a semester version, which is 15 weeks. And my response was, are you willing to put in the work? And then I stepped back and thought, okay, wait a minute, Susan. It's another form of practice, education. And I'm a lifelong lover of education, right? I taught for years in higher education. I have way too many degrees because I love going to school. But it's a practice. Educating yourself is a practice. You learn about things through the practice of studying or doing and or doing. And this is a practice. Mudita is a practice. Heart-opening practices of the Brahmaviharas are, again, a practice. We don't improve on them. Our heart doesn't open wider if we don't put in the work. Mudita is a vital tool for moving past the subtle ego-clinging trap of spiritual materialism. It forces us to examine where our practice remains self-centered and opens a doorway into the realization of the interconnectedness that is heart-opening practices. If there is no rigid, isolated self, then another person's joy is literally, beautifully, our own joy. Did you hear that? If we're not focused on our own stuff, somebody else's joy becomes ours. Just because we're not focused on our own stuff. So why practice this? Why practice mudita? We're doing loving kindness, right? Okay, we're doing metta, we're doing that. We're doing compassion and self-compassion. We're doing equanimity. Why do one more? Well, mudita is an antidote to jealousy. Anybody ever feel that green monster of jealousy? Do you ever feel that? Ever rear its ugly head in your world anytime in your life? Mudita directly counters envy and the I'm better than thinking that we all have had at some point or another. It also helps with connecting and healing. It strengthens relationships. It reduces loneliness. If we're joyful and happy for somebody else's successes and we share that opens us up to other people and other connections. And universal joy allows us to experience joy more often, not just when we're successful or we have a win, for want of a better word, but when anyone is successful. Doesn't matter how well we know them, even. We're just happy somebody's happy. How beautiful is that? If somebody else is succeeding, isn't that great? Somebody finished school. Fabulous. Somebody went back to school. Congrats. Somebody lost weight. Wonderful. They got the job. Great. So, what's an obstacle to all this? Because, right now it just sounds like joy. Everybody's joyful. We have all this. We just have to think about somebody else's joy and it's going to be there. No, not really. It's difficult. This practice is difficult. We are wired with a negativity bias. It feels safer to us to track threats and ranking of our social status than celebrating what we consider a rival to be doing. Psychologists separate envy into two distinct types. One is malicious envy. It's painful. It's a destructive emotion where we want to pull the other person down, damage their success, or actively wish for their failure to level the playing field. You see this a lot in television shows, and our teenagers and young folks watch stuff like Mean Girls and other shows that blow up the idea that this is a fabulous thing to have people tear each other down. We know just from the title, Malicious Envy, this isn't going to be good, right? But then there's this other one, this other type. It's benign envy. Even the title doesn't sound bad. That is a longing for what the other person has, which can serve as motivation, but still leaves us feeling inadequate, lacking, and emotionally dysregulated. Take a minute, take a deep breath, let it out, and think about a time where you wished somebody wasn't as successful as they were at any point in your life. Or you longed for what the other person had. Because you didn't feel adequate. You felt like you were lacking. Have you ever felt either one of those? I know I felt both. Okay? I've had both of those happen. Festinger's social comparison theory explains that human beings have a drive to evaluate their own opinions and abilities by comparing themselves to others. When we engage in upward social comparison, where we're looking at somebody who we perceive as better off, our self-esteem naturally drops, which triggers a th threat response in our amygdala. I have a hard time with this word, amygdala. Envy is literally our brain misinterpreting someone else's success as a personal attack on our safety. Because we're wired this way. We're wired to compete. So when you contrast this with mudita, sympathetic joy, which psychological researchers classify as a form of pro-social positive emotion or capitalization. And capitalization, when used in the psychological framework, is the act of relishing and supporting someone else's good fortune. So you're relishing and supporting someone else's good fortune. And research shows that practicing capitalization this way actively lowers cortisol levels, which strengthens relational bonds. It activates the brain's reward centers just as strongly as if we had won that particular prize or had that particular success. The practice of mudita rewires the brain to see another's win not as a threat, but as a safe harbor. It's a good thing. So when we think of mudita, what's a near enemy of it? What is the quality that mimics mudita but actually undermines it? Exuberance or clinging. And this happens when we get overexcited about someone's material wealth out of greed or when we project our own egos onto others, like parents who obsess over a child's achievements to validate themselves. Now, think about lottery winners. If you've ever done any Googling of past lottery winners, you'll see a lot of them aren't alive anymore or lost all their money because their families and people they didn't know were relatives. Other folks came around and got their money. Sometimes they were killed for it. All of this was out of greed. And we've seen books and movies and TV shows about parents living their lives through their children's achievements. I had a kid who did some work in theater, and theater moms can be atrocious what they push their kids to. Dance moms, the same kid went to school for dance and went to college for dance. And how people would push or want to see their child reach certain levels because they couldn't. It was validating themselves, not being joyful over their child and their child's accomplishments. True mudita is clean, it is free of attachment. We're not grasping or clinging to somebody else's wealth, we're not a hanger-on. It is rooted in unconditional goodwill. Now let's think about this for a second. We've talked about it's intentional. We've talked about it being a practice. We've talked about it being difficult because of how we're wired. We've talked about things that get in the way of it. Two kinds of envy. We've talked about the difference between malicious and benign envy. We've talked about mudita and the practice of it being an antidote to jealousy. It increases our being able to strengthen relationships and reduces loneliness. And as I was researching this topic tonight, I was surprised that in my meditation practice of, oh, it's almost 20 years at this point, I hadn't heard as much about it. Looking back over notes from places I've gone, one-day retreats, workshops, various styles of meditation. Loving kindness is everywhere, which is a great thing. Compassion practices is a big deal now, even more so lately. But sympathetic joy wasn't taught as much. And I asked myself why. Not 100% sure, but my thought pattern is that it's difficult, this practice. Getting over judging ourselves, comparing ourselves to others is hard work, and it is work. Dealing with envy, opening our heart more. So we are having this joyous experience with anyone and being okay with it is work. So I thought with tonight's talk, I want to do a very brief 5-minute guided meditation, if you all will indulge me. So get yourself comfortable, however that may be. If you are on Zoom with me, if you're more comfortable turning your camera off, that's cool. No worries. You can look away from the camera if that makes you feel better. You can lay down, you can sit up, whatever works for you. And we're going to anchor this teaching in the body for the next 5 minutes. So find yourself a posture that balances your alertness with ease. Let your shoulders drop. If you're like me, that may mean you have to roll your shoulders to help them drop. Close your eyes or lower your gaze. You can turn off your camera. Take a deep breath in, hold it, and slowly blow it out. And I want you to bring to mind a loved one, a benefactor, or a dear friend who has recently experienced a moment of joy, or a moment of peace, or a moment of good fortune. See their face clearly in your mind's eye. Notice the lightness in their energy. Now, as you see their face, direct these phrases to them silently. I want you to match the words to the natural rhythm of your breath. I rejoice in your happiness. May your good fortune continue and grow. Once more, I rejoice in your happiness. May your good fortune continue and grow. Now shift your focus to a neutral person. Perhaps it's a fellow Sangha member you don't know well, or a stranger that you saw today. Imagine them experiencing a moment of ease or a moment of joy. Offer them the same wishes. I rejoice in your happiness. May your good fortune continue and grow. Add the phrase, may your joy continue. And finally, for just a brief moment, think of someone with whom you feel a competitive edge or a spark of envy. Picture them. Notice any tightness in your chest or your shoulders. Breathe into the tightness. If you feel tightness anywhere else, breathe into it. Soften the edges of your heart. And try offering a simple, I wish you well. May you be happy. Take one deep centering breath, releasing the practice, and return your awareness to the room. So, how do we do this practice? We heard it's difficult. And if you've ever dealt with feeling envious, grasping on to somebody else's success, had those thoughts of why them, not me, you know it's difficult. So how do we do mudita in daily life? We start small. We focus on someone we care for, dear friend or a loved one, having a success, and we use the mantra, may your happiness continue. May your happiness continue. When we hear good news, rather than feeling envy, stop, pause, and mentally say, how wonderful. If that phrase doesn't work with you, that's awesome. That's so great. Whatever phrase fits for you. Appreciate goodness and actively look for successes, large and small, in the world around you. In the mornings, I've taken to walking our food forest in our backyard. And right now, I'm on the search for monarch caterpillar cocoons. And that success of that caterpillar making a cocoon, I'm like, wow, good for you. That's wonderful. Because the struggles they go through to be able to do that and not get eaten by a bird is fabulous. It's a little thing, but it brings joy to the start of my day. It doesn't have to be huge. Those successes don't have to be astronomical. It could be small. My brother sends pictures of flowers opening in his home in Nashville to our family chat, and everybody's like, God, that's beautiful. Those little tiny successes make you a smile. So look for those. And at the beginning, we talked about practice, and I said, we're going to come back to this. And I talked about my friend who asked about going to school and could they do it? One of the stories I told her was I started taking piano at six because my 14-year-old sister wanted to take piano and then realized she didn't want to take piano, but my parents had bought the piano. So, guess who had to take lessons? I promise I play better today than I did when I was six. And why is that? Because I practiced every day, the beginning for a half an hour, and later in life for an hour a day, every day, all the way through college, because I originally went to college as a music major, performance major. Practice helps us improve. And formal meditation builds muscle, like tonight. But our daily life is the gym, and the gym is the walk in my food forest. Find your gym. Where are you finding little successes? Do you have children in your neighborhood and you see a toddler learning to walk or learning to ride the bicycle? That's a little older than a toddler, but or learning to run. What are the successes that make you smile for other people? That's your gym. That's daily life for our practice. Part of my practice is something I call habit stacking. And habit stacking is basically when you anchor a new mindfulness habit to something you're already doing as part of your daily routine. So, for example, if in the morning when you get up, you open up your phone and you're looking at social media, you may say to yourself, after I open my phone and scroll past someone's good news, I will pause for 3 seconds and mentally say, I am genuinely happy for you. Before I move on, one little thing. If you're commuting to work and you're sitting in traffic, or you're walking into your building and you see somebody laughing, you can use their laughter, their happiness, their joy as a visual cue to breathe in their joy and wish them well inside. You're at work. A colleague shares a win during your morning meeting. Right after the meeting ends, send a quick, sincere message via email, Teams, Slack, whatever tool you use, celebrating them before you move on to something else. Doesn't take long. You get home. You're brushing your teeth before going to bed. Think about one good thing that happened to someone else today and feel glad about it while you're brushing your teeth. Now think for a moment. What stack might fit for you? I gave you several examples. They may or may not work, and that's okay. You may have to create your own. One of the ones I do is I have a coffee machine. When I press it to grind the beans, I think about how wonderful it is that someone picked those and then somebody else roasted them and they smell as wonderful as they do. And I say, thank you. That works for me. What works for you? Create your own habit stack. So let's recap. If we only rejoice in our own success, our joy is small and it's vulnerable. If we learn to rejoice in everyone's successes, our joy becomes infinite and unshakable. I want to thank everyone for your collective energy and your willingness to come to the meeting this evening and your willingness to do the 5 minute sit with me. Trying something new. Thank you for your practice. Any questions or comments?
I really loved this talk. Thank you so much. Such an interesting and insightful way to look at this concept. And it occurred to me when you were talking about the noticing. I think that's, I'm going back to the teaching, the Buddhist teaching that says note and name. And I'm thinking how I think a lot of us do feel, I would like to think that I feel happy when I see these things, but sometimes our brain is working so fast, we're not slowing down enough that we can actually note it. Take a moment to actually note it and name it. And to me, that is a helpful little nudge for me to do the practice. But I thank you very much. I think your approach to teaching us about how to practice it is very good and very helpful. You often don't see that link with the practice
Thank
so
you.
much. Yeah.
Thank you. And I find it incredibly important and sometimes have to shake myself going, oh, the years I missed and not slowing down. Right. And, I was grateful. I worked in New York City for quite a while and was grateful for their green spaces and would find a little green space in the middle of a bunch of high rises and sit and look at flowers as a way to just notice beauty and joy and the happiness of bees finding pollen. But if we don't take those moments, how does our heart open? Even wider than doing loving kindness or metta meditations. So thank you, Leslie. Other thoughts, questions, concerns? Peter.
Yes, I very much appreciate your telling us of your what you're learning, Susan. What I've discovered for myself is that the more I can cultivate, it's called samadhi paucity. Samadhi is this stability of attention. Paucity is tranquility. The more I can do that, the more I'm able to realize joy. And it's a feeling of a buoyancy, being uplifted. And that supports the sympathetic joy process for me. And I find that it's very similar or strongly associated with generosity. When I have been deliberately generous to other people, because of that, my meditation practice, I can bring joy to that experience, and that joy kind of flows out. So joy is not necessarily because of another person's happiness. It's that there's a happiness in me that I bring with the generosity. That's part of that sympathetic joy in my experience. And also, about a month ago, my wife keeps a glass next to where she sits to watch television. And she has water in it. For some reason, probably this, what I was just talking about, I decided that I'm going to be aware of when that glass is empty, and I'm going to go fill it. And there's a particular faucet in the house that she thinks the water's better coming out of. Okay, fine. I'm going to do that. I'm going to go there and I'm going to fill that up. And I feel joy when I see the glass and I get to fill it. And the joy is already there, sort of like it becomes amplified. And when I do this, part of what goes through my mind is something from Dune, may you never thirst. So that's part of my little stacking, I guess, as you refer to.
Right. Yeah, it's a habit you've stacked, which is great. And last month one of the talks I did was Joy and Tranquility. So thank you for talking about how that has helped move you into sympathetic joy as well. But I think us having our joy and happiness with us when we're with others comes from our heart opening even more. Because of our practices.
Yes.
So, as our heart is opening to others, our joy is already there and bubbling, right? So, and that initial practice, though, that we struggle with is where we're learning to do that, where you may have those glitches, bumps in the road, whatever you want to call it. So, finding the little things like filling the water helps that expand for us. So great example, Peter. Thank you.
And it's fun.
Yeah.
It's like a game for me.
Ooh, serious expressions on the Zoom channel. I can't see the people in the room, but
The piece here in the room has something.
yep, please.
Comment. So when we celebrate other people's joy, I think we may be transcending our ego, or maybe it happened because we have transcended our ego, and our reaction to other people's successes and failure is a big reflection on us,
Yes.
and indication of where we are. Likewise. And also it helps, I'm guessing it helps being compassionate with ourselves. Whatever we want to be with ourselves, I believe it, we can do it, achieve it faster if we are doing the same thing to other people and other outside us.
Yeah, and I think it gives us an opportunity when we share their joy to look internally and make sure we're not clinging. How wholehearted was my experience with them and their recognizing their success and understanding their happiness. Was there any envy in there? Was there any twinge? And that goes to what you were saying about what that says about us, right? But we can't figure out what it says about us if we don't investigate how we're feeling when we hear what their success was. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Yep, Leslie. And then April and
Yeah,
then Peter.
that oh,
No,
me?
you're first.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, that helps a lot, Susan. Thank you. Because I was thinking, I have a dear friend who's an artist, and she started out as a client of mine and was a really star client, and has moved from being in the working world, the technical working world, into becoming a full-time artist. And she's become very successful, and I like this woman a lot, and she's super, super talented, and I'm just happy for every single gallery opening that she has or sale that she makes. And but at the same time, I would say, when you ask that question about is there anybody that you feel jealous of, or I don't think I'm jealous of her, but I'm deeply envious. I don't know if that's a fine too fine a distinction to make, but I do think, I mean, I praise her. I am ha truly happy for her, but there is a little part of me that goes, damn, why can't I do that? I have not. So and I liked early on you said you used the word comparison, that they say comparison is the thief of joy. So anyway, I'm just wondering if you have come across or if you can think of any antidotes to that. I don't know that that's a healthy, beneficial feeling for me to be having about somebody I truly love, and I want goodness for her, but it always seems to slide in a little bit to the diminuing me in a little bit. Oh, I'm not there. I'm not. I love it for you, but damn, why can't I be there too?
Well, and that goes back to the two kinds of envy, right?
Yeah.
That goes right back to what we talked about at the beginning, and that we're going, why couldn't it have been me? Or why couldn't I have some of that? Whatever. So it's not the malicious envy.
Yeah.
It's more the benign envy that makes you feel maybe a little lacking. And the first part of our practice for this is having the insight to notice it, which you've done,
Yeah.
right? You mentioned
Yeah.
it, you've noticed it, you know
Yeah.
it's there, and that tells you where you got to work.
Yeah, good point.
That pinpoints that this is an area I'm still struggling with. So what does that look like? Can I, when I feel that, can I stop it and go pause and go, I'm truly happy for her, and let it go.
Yeah.
And sometimes that pause, in another lifetime mine, when I was a family therapist, I would tell people, to stop those thoughts by picturing a stop sign. Stop. Whatever sign you need right there, going, no, we're not moving into that. So you're recognizing it. And the more you recognize it, and the sooner you recognize it, the shorter those envious thoughts are going to
Yeah,
be.
good point.
So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
April.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting to what Leslie just said, because this made me think of a beautiful story. I was watching Linda Ronstadt's documentary a long time ago, a few years ago, and there's a scene where she's talking about, she's just basically emerging on the scene with her music and her mix of country and what she was doing. And then she's at some sort of show and she sees Emmylou Harris for the first time. And she's like, oh no, like this person is doing exactly what I'm doing. I'm lost. I'm doomed, right? Like it's game over, right? And then she said in that moment she had to make a decision and something guided her. She chose to basically join her and to say, we're like, Leslie, you've mentioned this image and I've had it in my mind many times too, different wildflowers in the field, that there's room for both of them. And so she had this moment of insight where she said, we're just gonna both be doing this. And little did she know that eventually they would become part of a famous trio with Dolly Parton. And, but, it's just an example of, that moment of that comparison thinking and that envy and that worry and that fear. And then it just ended up blossoming and into a brilliant career. And all three of them had brilliant careers. So.
Thanks for sharing. That's a great example of somebody famous even going, uh-oh, here's this, and thinking to herself. And when you, if you don't know Linda Ronstadt, she's got perfect pitch and an incredible voice, and has always been thought of as one of the premier female vocalists. And sadly, her voice has been robbed from her, but for her to go, oh, here's somebody doing my thing, I may have to stop. And then recognizing Leslie's example of the flowers, they can all be in the same place. So thank you for sharing that. Peter, you had your hand up before.
Yes, I was remembering the near enemy of compassion is pity, and we think of pity as that's compassion, but it creates a sense of separation. One of the characteristics of pity is it diminishes the other person. The same would be true in terms of envy, that this there's a sense of diminishment of oneself, a separation. And loving kindness is all about communion, about unification. About we're all in this together. Let's be kind to one another. So that was an interesting insight that just occurred to me as you were talking. About the similarity between pity and that sense of envy. The other thing is fan joy, which is rampant these days with the World Cup and the hockey finals and the basketball finals. That's part of the near enemy of sympathetic joy, is rooting for the home team. They win, the world is wonderful. And when they lose, the world is terrible. So those are other attributes, I think, that are important to understand about this notion of sympathetic joy.
And along with that, one of the small things I've observed is on social media, there was a video clip of fans from Norway doing a Viking row coming up the escalator. So they're all sitting down and rowing. And so they're all in their Norway jerseys coming up the escalator. And it was just fabulous, that they're that excited. Their team is in, and just seeing them do that and having fun, harmless fun, nobody, it's not anything like mean girl kind of stuff that people think is fun. It was just harmless, spot on fun that just made me smile and feel so much lighter to see that. So there's the type where Peter was talking about, where if the home team doesn't win, life is over and they're crushed. Versus here we are and we're here and we're in the cup and watch us row up the escalator. So You know, what makes you smile?
I think also there's an element of this notion of having a lack mentality instead of an abundance. I'm thinking especially
it's
about
scarcity,
the Linda Ronstadt example, that so often we think, oh, if she's successful, she's doing it, then there's no room for me to do it, which is totally not true, right? Now, I don't think that applies to gaming because somebody has to lose in a basketball game. But, you know, in most situations we're in it because somebody else succeeds doesn't mean, I mean, isn't that, those of you that are therapists, isn't that some place on the disorder system where you can't be happy for somebody else because it seems like it's taking away my opportunity to be
Yes,
happy.
the scarcity thoughts of if you have it, that means I don't.
Yeah.
And
It's
I'm
not enough for
lacking.
both of
It's
us.
not enough for both.
Yeah.
And that happens. April. And
And
then
then
Steve, I'll jump over to you.
And then one of the aspects of good sportsmanship is the end of the game when the teams high five each other and say, you know, because they know ultimately they're in. So the healthy ones, right, that we're in this whole picture together and, you know, good game and good sportsmanship. So it's another interesting dimension to see, to do like a temperature check on that.
Steve.
Hey, Susan, thanks so
Hey.
much tonight.
Thank you.
I wonder just to what extent negativity feeds into this, because, you know, we among the things that are probably near enemies, and I don't know that this fits, but just the desire for others to feel joy, or the desire for what we do to cause them to feel joy, and in the process we feel joy. And yet so often during the day I just find myself connected with people who just are, you know, really negative. And that negativity has storylines, and it's difficult to be necessarily around them. And sometimes that negativity is so aggressive that, you know, you feel the reaction, your reactivity to it. And that's certainly no joy that, you know, comes from anything that we do.
True. And that, I mean, if you look at the malicious envy, it's painful and destructive, where people want to pull somebody else down, you know, where they damage their success, or they're actively wishing for their failure, or they're so angry about that person being successful, they make up stuff. There's, you know, that you can see this all over today's world, where folks are making up things about other people who were successful. And what does that say about where they are in their heart? And how do we deal with that if we're the object of that? Right? So there's a lot of examples, which, not to get political, so I'm not going to give those examples, but there's a lot of examples out there of folks just coming up with things that aren't true and trying to tear other people down because they had something that this other person wanted and they didn't think they should have it. So, you know, that's very malicious and negative and destructive.
Or just that we want things to be different.
Yes.
Or we want others to act differently.
Yeah,
and
we
how
want
that plays from, you know, those who don't practice at all, right? And
right.
And how negative that really can be. I mean,
yeah.
That's why I guess I find that being in nature, I connect with a sympathetic joy just so much easier to just be, non-conceptual and just be in awe of the things that I experience there. So much different.
I can find it much easier in nature. I can also find it much easier with young children. And I was very fortunate when my two older grandsons were young. They lived in St. Pete, and we had them for one whole summer because our daughter had to go do an internship. So we had the 4 and 3 year old at that time. They're 15, and they're going to be 15, and the other one's 13 this year. And just their wide-eye wonder at what they were experiencing was crazy. My other half, the boys wanted to learn how to play t-ball. So what happened in our backyard? All of a sudden, I've got a baseball diamond that was mowed into the yard. And I'm like, we're doing what? We're creating a what? But it was so fun watching them try and learning about it. And the little legs running the bases was ecstatic for me. The first time, luckily, one of my kids worked at Disney, so we could get into Disney free. And the first time the boys got on the tram from the parking lot, they thought that was a ride. I'm like, fabulous. And then the bus, that was a ride. And then the monorail, that was a ride. We wouldn't have had to go into the park at all. We could have just gone around, and they were thrilled. But when they got to go in and see all this, their wide eyes, their smiles, their absolute innocent joy helped my heart open so much. Who knew being a grandparent would be this exciting and fun? And I'm so happy that my daughter opted to give me three grandkids. So, but that's, for me, it's nature and children are my joy. And music, that's the other one. So, go ahead, Steve. You were going to say something else? No, you're good? Okay. Peter? And then we'll come down to Robin. Sorry about that, Robin. Didn't see your hand till the last second. Go ahead, Peter.
He mentioned psychological aspects, something psychologists call an external locus of control. And it basically means that your happiness or your failure, your sense of being a success or a failure is determined by something that happens that's outside your control, basically. So that's an important thing to understand, is this whole practice is about cultivating internal locus of control. And the other aspect of the generosity that's a near enemy. I'm going to give you a gift that I think is perfect for you, and you better appreciate it. So that notion of joy depends on the other person's applause for your generosity or your kindness or whatever. That's also we're all vulnerable to that as well.
Robin?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Susan. You said something that I didn't quite get the last end of it. You said someone's success, we see someone's success as a personal attack on ours. Was that what you said?
Yes.
Yeah. So I just thought that was amazing. And it led me to think about times when I've had those, the malicious, and then going to, the clinging. And I think what happened to me is when I wasn't becoming the person I was supposed to be, like, I wasn't getting new hobbies or getting another degree that really helped me get to a career I really wanted to do. That's when I was so envious of other people's success because I wasn't really in my life focused on what I could do or who I could become. And of course, as soon as I do that or take one little more step or risk or whatever it is, then when other people have success, I'm happy for them. And I noticed too that I don't draw, I don't paint, I have no intentions of doing it. And so when someone is, one of my friends has become really good at it, and you know, I'm just so happy for her. And then I have to think, well, what about if it is something that I like to do? Then it changes a little bit, you know, because then I can get envious. So why it's the painting and the music and that kind of thing, I'm good. When it comes to the writing, then I have to really work at it because I want to be the better writer. I want to be the better, you know. But I think that the epiphany that I had when you were speaking is that when I'm not, you know, following my success or just really being in my light, trying to achieve, not trying to achieve, letting it unfold, then I'm just so happy for other people. But the moment I step outside that, then, you know, or I slack off or don't meditate or whatever it is, or you know, don't continue to learn, then that's when I become envious. You know, that's when those emotions come up. So
And
thank you
thank
for that.
you. Oh, thank you for sharing. That's awesome that you did. And you bring up excellent examples of the importance of having insight into ourselves. That, you know, the example you give of your friend doing stuff that's not your thing is fabulous, and that you're there 100% joyful and thrilled with their successes. But we all have in us, oh, wait a minute, you're coming in my sphere. And are you better at that than me? And I will tell you that I have two kids who are adults, but my oldest is a girl, and I put her into martial arts to learn self-defense. My next child is a boy, and I put him in martial arts to learn how to block because he speaks without thinking, and I knew he was going to have to learn how to block to save his pretty face. Okay. And my daughter was really good at martial arts, really good. Would go to Junior Olympics in martial arts, really good. She got accepted to the United States Naval Academy for college, and plebe summer, which is the first summer you go, she broke her leg when running. She had a high stress fracture right under her knee. So she spent the entire first year on crutches and being what she calls a drag on her company, because they all live together. 5,000 students at the Naval Academy live in the dorms, and you're graded not only on your grades, but on your physical abilities, your military knowledge, all that stuff. And as she got better, and she had to have three surgeries her freshman year to fix, she had the first surgery to fix the break, and then they messed up some of that, so she had to have a couple more surgeries. And I asked her, why aren't you practicing your martial arts? And her response was, because I can't do what I used to do. Her forms, which are called kata in Japanese style, because of her leg break, her right foot doesn't flex like it used to anymore because of some of the issues they had with the titanium plate they put in. So she cannot flex her foot straight anymore. And so it doesn't look as nice and pretty as it did pre leg break and surgeries. And in her mind, her doing this and seeing somebody else do her realm, and she's not as good because she can't flex that foot, she didn't even want to compete in that anymore. And so she's been working on how much of that is grief, totally different topic than what we talked about tonight, and how much of it is envy that they have what I don't have anymore. And I want it back. So that's another part of having the insight into what's going on in here to open our heart and be happy for that other person who's doing that beautiful form, even though I can't do it. Does that make sense? And tie into what we're saying. I feel like I'm babbling at this point. My apologies. But envy becomes such a beast. And it sits. You know, you think of the old cartoons with the devil and the angel on your shoulders. I think envy sits here and talks to us. Whether it's malicious or benign, it's still not healthy. But insight helps us see it so we know where to work. So that's the good thing.
Thank you so much. That was
Oh,
wonderful.
thank you. And Peter, I'm noticing time. We have 4 minutes. So I will give it back to Peter. Thank you all. And thanks for the questions and conversations. I really love that. Appreciate it so much. And Peter, it's yours.
Thank you, Susan, for your excellent presentation. But also in the context of what you just said, one of the important faculties to be developed in order to maximize the benefit and minimize the threat of the near and far enemy of all of Brahma Viharas is equanimity. And interestingly enough, Leslie's going to be sharing her thoughts about that during our next meeting. It's our custom at the end of our gathering to sit together briefly in silence. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice and your participation. Wish you well. Hope we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to gather.